Welcome to the Penguin Podcast.
Hello and season's greetings. Welcome to the final Penguin Podcast of 2014. This has been a busy year for us penguins, and we wanted to share with you our favourite moments from 2014 in a sort of oral box of Quality Street. We've had prize-winning and record-breaking books from Richard Flanagan to YouTube sensation Zoella, thrilling new releases from much-loved authors, as well as striking and innovative debuts. We hope you'll enjoy this brief choco-literary reminiscence, and we hope we've got something for everyone, even those weirdos who actually like the strawberry creams. Now, we couldn't do our highlights without mentioning the Booker Prize shortlisted authors. Ali Smith, Joshua Ferris, Neil Mukherjee, and of course the winner, Richard Flanagan. Flanagan's book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, has been hailed as a masterpiece, not just by us, I should say. It's a story of love and tragedy set against the backdrop of a Japanese prisoner of war camp, and is an enthralling read. If you don't yet know it, here's a little extract.
Why at the beginning of things is there always light? Dorrigo Evans' earliest memories were of sun flooding a church hall in which he sat with his mother and grandmother. A wooden church hall, blinding light and him toddling back and forth, in and out of its transcendent welcome into the arms of women. Women who loved him. Like entering the sea and returning to the beach, over and over. Bless you, his mother says as she holds him and lets him go. Bless you, boy. That must have been 1915 or 1916. He would have been one or two. Shadows came later in the form of a forearm rising up, its black outline leaping in the greasy light of a kerosene lantern. Jackie Maguire was sitting in the Evans' small dark kitchen, crying. No one cried then, except babies. Jackie Maguire was an old man, maybe 40, perhaps older, and he was trying to brush the tears away from his pockmarked face with the back of his hand. Or was it with his fingers? Only his crying was in Dorrigo Evans' memory fixed. It was a sound like something breaking. Its slowing rhythm reminded him of a rabbit's hind legs thumping the ground as it strangled by a snare, the only sound he had ever heard that was similar. He was 9, had come inside to have his mother look at a blood blister on his thumb, and had little else to compare it to. He'd seen a grown man cry only once before, a scene of astonishment when his brother Tom returned from the Great War in France and got off the train. He had swung his kit bag onto the hot dust of the siding and abruptly burst into tears. Watching his brother, Dorrigo Evans had wondered what it was that would make a grown man cry. Later, crying became simply affirmation of feeling, and feeling the only compass in life. Feeling became fashionable, and emotion became a theatre in which people were players who no longer knew who they were off the stage. Dorrigo Evans would live long enough to see all these changes, and he would remember a time when people were ashamed of crying, when they feared the weakness it bespoke, the trouble to which it led. He would live to see people praised for things that were not worthy of praise, simply because truth was seen to be bad for their feelings. That night Tom came home, they burnt the Kaiser on a bonfire. Tom said nothing of the war, of the Germans, of the gas and the tanks and the trenches they had heard about. He said nothing at all. One man's feeling is not always equal to all life is. Sometimes it's not equal to anything much at all. He just stared into the flames.
The Narrow Road to the Deep North by Richard Flanagan, winner of the Booker Prize 2014. From literary prize winners to chart record breakers, the recent debut from Zoe Sugg, a.k.a. Zoella, reached the highest first-week sales of any book since records began. The audiobook team here had a wonderful time recording it with Hannah Toynton, star of The Inbetweeners and Hollyoaks, and we caught up with her about how she found the book and also the whole audiobook experience.
First of all, congratulations, because Hannah Toynton, you have just read what is your first audiobook.
My first audiobook. I'm so excited. I can't believe I've managed it.
What was the whole process like for you?
I didn't really know what to expect, and I didn't really realise how difficult it would be. But it's been such a great challenge, and I've actually found my reading has got better through the process, and I've just really enjoyed it. I've loved doing all the different characters, and what's been lovely is just reading this wonderful book, and I really feel like I've got into the story every time I've been in this room, so it's been wonderful.
It's a romantic comedy. I'm not going to give any more away than
yes.
that. But what I really liked about it was a particular kind of warmth to the narrator.
Absolutely.
The main character, Girl Online.
Yes.
Partly because she's unhappy with her appearance, but
yes.
she isn't overwhelmed by that. She has panic attacks, and the book deals really well with how to cope with that, as well as other anxieties, love,
yes.
friends, school, and all the rest of it. What about it for you did you most enjoy? Which part of the book were you happiest reading?
Well, I think what sort of struck me as soon as I read it is how relatable this character was. And I think every girl has those insecurities. And it was just lovely to read something where she really did, really nailed that, you know, how horrible and scary it is growing up. And the thing I really loved about the book is all about how she faces her anxiety and all the different techniques, because I think it's really important for young people growing up to know that there are things that you can do when you're in these stressful situations. And I was really impressed and really pleased to see that here is a book for young people, you know, discussing that and things, you know, therapy tricks and things like that. And I think that was my favourite book, really, when you got to see her exploring those ideas.
I also just think the narrator has several different voices. There's the voice she gives to us,
yes.
the reader. But then there's the one she has when she's actually writing her blog,
yes.
her Girl Online entries. And producing your reading, I really enjoyed the way you moved between those two tones. Were you aware of doing that when you were reading it?
Yes, I think the blog parts are her at her most vulnerable. And, you know, I really am aware that, you know, if you're writing a diary or, you know, you're putting everything down, you do see a very soft side, and, you know, that's you at your most sort of open. And so that's what I tried to sort of bring to it, whether that came through or not. But that's what I tried to go with.
But also she was, you know, deliberately cheerful. She was presenting herself
yes.
to the world saying,
absolutely.
You know, I am terrified, but this is a thing that might help. How about you? And she was that again, I just thought was a very, just a warm-hearted, generous nature.
Oh, I know. Thank you. I'm glad that you felt like that. But no, I really do feel those blogs were lovely, because it's her trying to, you know, reach out and see if other people feel the same. And that's the wonderful thing about being online, is that you can find these people that you'd never really speak to in real life and sort of share your stories. And I think that really comes across.
You mentioned that the thing you liked about the book was the fact that it felt so relatable. Were there any particular yes. instance where you went, oh, that's so like me?
Oh, dear. Yes, I remember I fell over on stage once when I was younger. I was about 12. And I was coming on to take a bow, and I ran on, and I skidded from one side to the other. So there is a point in the book that, if you read it, that's very similar. Well, not quite, but it just brought back all these horrible memories that I had of that moment. So very similar to what I went through.
And just to get back to the audiobook, you were approached, and we got a reply very quickly saying you'd be very interested in doing it.
Yes.
Can you tell me why you thought it would be something you'd like to do?
Yes. I sort of researched Zoella, and also I really wanted to do an audiobook because it's something I've never done before. And as I sort of found out more about her, and I thought she looked really fun and interesting, and it just seemed like a really exciting thing to do. And then I read the book, and it, you know, I really loved it. I fell in love with it. And I thought it would be great to sort of explore this.
Having spent 4 days locked in a small room reading out loud, do you still feel as enthusiastic about audiobooks?
I really do. I really would love to do more, and I've really enjoyed this experience. It's been fantastic. So thank you for everything. Thank you for being patient with me.
Hannah Toynton, talking about reading Zoella's debut novel, Girl Online. Now, whatever you think about YouTube vloggers and their extraordinary popularity, you will not be able to deny their reach, their almost imperceptible influence, and their considerable success, all of which are lessons in successful brand and personality management that most business leaders envy. Most. One business leader has already got much of that taped, Sir Richard Branson. His latest book, The Virgin Way, is full of advice and learning on becoming a truly successful leader. He spent 4 days in our studios in London. No, he didn't. He decided to record his own audio version of his own book on his own island in the Caribbean. That's how you know you've made it.
From my first commercial venture when I was 16 with Student Magazine, right up to today's far loftier adventures with such things as Virgin Galactic and space tourism, I've always had one paramount philosophy. If a new project or business opportunity doesn't excite me and get my entrepreneurial juices flowing, if it's not something with which I sense I can make a difference while having a lot of seriously creative fun, then I'd rather pass on it and move along to something else that does excite me. This same line of thought flows into my attitude towards writing books. After all, if I don't enjoy writing them, then the chances are pretty good that nobody is going to be too happy reading them. The simple fact is that if you don't enjoy what you're doing, then there is no possible way that you're ever going to do it as well as something that you do enjoy. As some wise person once said, life is not a dress rehearsal. This is it. So, unless you plan to give it a better shot in your next life, assuming you're lucky enough to get a second chance, then why risk wasting any of your limited time on this earth doing stuff that doesn't light your fire? I'm constantly amazed at how many people appear to live their lives either constantly looking in the rear mirror or talking about how things are going to be different in the future. There is nothing wrong with cherishing memories and hopefully learning from past experiences, just as planning for the future is something we obviously all have to do as well. But what about today? All too frequently, now gets lost in the frenetic shuffle to rush ahead to tomorrow. Mahatma Gandhi is one of my all-time heroes, and a quote from him that I think I first read in a school history lesson has struck me ever since. Live as if you were to die tomorrow, learn as if you were to live forever. This good advice has been popularly abbreviated to live every day as if it were your last, which is a wonderful sentiment, even if it has frequently become a worldwide rallying cry for, never mind the consequences, hellraisers. I remember well the one time, as an apprentice hellraiser, I tried using the latter version of my mum as an excuse for some mischief or other. But mum, I implored, I was only doing what Gandhi said I should do. Unimpressed, she gave me a straight-faced reply of, pull that trick again, Ricky, and today could very well be your last.
Richard Branson, recording for us from his home on Necker Island. Now, don't be downhearted if you don't own your own island from which to record your own books, though. Everyone has to start somewhere. For Richard Branson, it was the crypt of a church and a telephone box. And one thing Penguin has done with passion and success all through its history and this year is promote the new, the unfound, the undiscovered. One of the most successful debuts of 2014 was Emma Healy. She started with decal edging and back cornering. She used to be a bookbinder. Then she decided to create the contents too, and came up with a thrilling, gripping and poignant novel, Elizabeth is Missing.
I'm here with Emma Healy, who is the author of Elizabeth is Missing. Emma Healy grew up in London, where she completed her first degree in bookbinding, and she spent most of her working life in libraries, bookshops and galleries before completing her MA in creative writing at UEA in 2011. Elizabeth is Missing is her first novel. Emma, hi.
Hello.
So Emma, could you tell us a little bit about Elizabeth is Missing?
Sure. Well, it's a first-person narration by a lady who's in her early 80s and is beginning to show the signs of dementia. And she is convinced that her best friend, Elizabeth, has gone missing. The people around her, her daughter and her granddaughter and her carer, tell her that her friend is not missing, but she's absolutely convinced and determined to investigate anyway, spurred on by the memory of her older sister, Suki, going missing just after the Second World War.
So what was it about this story that drew you to it? What inspired you to write about this character and this this place?
Well, I'd always been interested in dementia since it started to show up in my family. About four or five members of my family began to show the signs when I was still a teenager. And I'd been kind of thinking about a story involving dementia in some way for quite a while. And then I'd always wanted to write, so I tried to write other things as well. I kept trying to write about something that was vaguely autobiographical about a young woman in London and, you know, her trials with her jobs and boyfriends and things. And it just seemed very tedious. And I couldn't really maintain any interest in it. And also I felt slightly inhibited because it felt like writing a diary or making some kind of confession to the reader. And then I was in the car with my dad and grandmother one day, and she said, "My friend is missing." And it turned out that her friend wasn't missing. She was staying with her daughter in another town. But it was kind of a trigger moment for me. I thought, well, what if her friend really had been missing? Or what if we hadn't been able to find out that she was staying with her daughter? What if my grandmother's dementia hadn't allowed her to remember what actually happened to the friend and she carried on believing she was missing? And those ideas went round and round in my head for about a year. I felt slightly uncomfortable about embarking on the story. I felt I was too young. I was only 22 when she said those things, and 23 when I began to put some ideas down. But within that time, my other grandmother, my mother's mother, became very ill and went into hospital. And I got a call while I was at work in London saying, "You have to get on a train straight away to come and say goodbye." And I was absolutely devastated knowing that she was dying. And the train journey, which was about 2 hours, was really difficult. I couldn't concentrate on reading and I really didn't know what to do with myself. So I decided I would write down every single memory I could remember my grandmother telling me about her early life. She was a very good storyteller, and so it was quite easy to remember a lot of them. And then when I got to the hospital, we went through those memories with her, and she loved to reminisce, so it was a lovely thing to be able to do. But it also gave me a chance to kind of fact check, make sure I got names right. And also I wanted to prove to her that I had been listening to all those stories that she told me about her life for all those years. I think sometimes it seems that grandchildren aren't listening to their grandparents, especially when their story has been told several times. And I wanted to prove that I had listened and taken them in. And then once I'd collected those, they somehow gave me a kind of confidence to depict someone else's time. And to depict an older person, I felt I kind of got the voice a little more firmly in my mind. And so the two things came together.
Emma Healy, talking about her experiences writing Elizabeth is Missing. Look out for the paperback edition in February. And if it's paperbacks you're looking for, keep your eyes on the figurative skies as a pale blue bird is back in the booky firmament. I'm not quite sure that all that metaphor crunching has worked, but the point is that Pelican Books was relaunched this year. They were first created in 1973 and aimed then and now, to be a series of fascinating, intelligent, accessible and concise books on topics as varied as economics and Russian history. We caught up with the team to find out all about getting the Pelican flying again.
So we have had the most exciting year for Pelican as the Pelican returned. Earlier this year in May, we saw the return of the much-loved imprint of Penguin Books, Pelican Books. Pelican first appeared in 1937 with the publication of George Bernard Shaw's The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism, Capitalism, Sovietism and Fascism, and continued with thousands of books across a massive range of subjects. Aimed at the everyday reader, Pelican's combined intellectual rigour with simple, clear, and accessible prose. In its heyday, Pelican was seen as influencing intellectual culture and sold over 250 million copies. The first Pelican books cost the same amount as a packet of cigarettes, a radical price at the time, and became especially popular among a self-educating post-war generation. We relaunched the series in May with books aimed at readers who like to think for themselves, with a little help from experts and to explore subjects out of curiosity without having to understand every new or every old argument. They're for the geographer who wants to read about physics or the musician who would like to know more about human evolution. They are, as well, books with an edge, inviting the reader to think again about essential topics. We started off the year with a bang. We had Economics from Harjun Chang, Human Evolution from Robin Dunbar, Revolutionary Russia by the incredible historian Orlando Figes, The Domesticated Brain by Bruce Hood, and Greek and Roman Political Ideas by Melissa Lane. Then in autumn this year, we took Pelican to the next level, launching the brand new Pelican Books website, offering a completely new way to read books online. The website allows readers to buy and read from pelicanbooks.com in their browser as well as across the full range of smartphones and tablets, aiming to create a flawless digital reading experience. Each book in the series has been designed from the ground up to make the most of the online medium and to be comfortable to read irrespective of device. The project was led by our art team member Matthew Young, who said that these books speak the same distinctive visual language as the paperback editions, but have been reimagined for the web and designed to be easily accessible, clear and easy to interpret, so of course uniquely Pelican. So it's been a very exciting year, and next year promises to be even more so, with 5 new books publishing, starting with Classical Literature in January by Richard Jenkins, Anthony King's Who Governs Britain in Time for the Election, and a book on visual culture, How to See the World by Nicholas Mertzoff in June.
And that's it for the Penguin podcast this year. I hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget, you can log on to our SoundCloud for tons of extra content and tweet us at Penguin Audio to share your own literary highlights. Have a wonderful holiday if you get one, and every best wish for the new year.
You've been listening to the Penguin Podcast.